easily outrun them, even as weighed down as we are.
Put me down, Sam finally says.
Are you okay? I put him down.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Sam is a little unsteady. Sweat beads his forehead, and he wipes it away with the sleeve of his jacket and takes a deep breath.
Come on,
Six says.
They aren't going to let us go that easily. We have 10 minutes, 15 at the most, until we're hiding from a helicopter.
We make for the hills. Six in the lead, then me, then Sam struggling to keep up. He moves much faster than when we ran the mile in gym class a few months ago. It feels like years ago. None of us looks back, but as soon as we reach the first incline, the howl of a bloodhound fills the air. One of the officers has brought a police dog. Any ideas? I ask Six.
I was hoping we could hide our stuff and go invisible. That would elude a copter, but the dog will still pick up our scent.
Shit, I say. I look around. There's a hill to our right. Let's get to the top and see what's on the other side, I say. Bernie Kosar zips ahead and disappears into the night sky. Six leads, stumbling wildly up. I follow behind her, and Sam, who is breathing heavily yet still moving swiftly, brings up the rear. We stop at the top, faint outlines of more hills as far as I can see. Nothing more. Very softly I hear the trickle of running water. I spin around. 8 sets of flashing lights line the highway, sandwiching Sam's father's truck. In the distance, coming from both directions, 2 more cop cars are speeding towards the scene. Bernie Kosar lands beside me and turns back into a beagle, tongue dangling. The police bloodhound barks, closer than before. There's no doubt that it's following our scent, which means that officers on foot can't be far behind.
We have to get the dog off our trail, Six says.
Can you hear that? I ask her.
Hear what?
The sound of water. I think there's some kind of stream at the bottom of this. Maybe a river.
I hear it,
Sam chimes in. An idea pops into my head. I unzip my jacket and remove my shirt. I wipe it across my face, my chest, soaking up every bit of sweat and scent I might have. I throw it at Sam. Do what I just did, I say.
No way, that's disgusting.
Sam, the entire state of Tennessee is hot on our trail. We don't have much time. He sighs, but obeys me. Six does too, unsure of what I have planned, but willing to go along with it. I put on a new shirt and slip on my jacket. Six tosses me the soiled shirt, and I rub it over Bernie Kosar's face and body. We're going to need your help, buddy. You up for it? I can hardly see him in the dark, but the sound of his tail thumping excitedly on the ground is unmistakable. Always eager to assist, happy to be alive. I can sense within him the odd thrill of being chased, and I can't help but feel it myself.
What's your plan? Six asks.
We have to hurry, I say, taking the first steps downhill towards the running water. Bernie Kosar again turns himself into a bird, and we race down, occasionally hearing the bloodhound bark and howl. It's closing the gap. If my idea fails, I wonder if I might communicate with it and tell it to stop following us. Bernie Kosar waits for us at the bank of the wide river, which has a still quality to its surface that tells me it's much deeper than it sounded from the top of the hill. We have to swim across, I say. There's no other choice.
What? John, do you understand what happens to the human body when it's in freezing water? Cardiac arrest from shock, for one. And if that doesn't kill you, then the loss of feeling in your arms and legs will make it impossible to swim. We'll freeze and drown,
Sam objects.
It's the only way to get the dog from following our scent. At least we'll have a chance this way.
This is suicide. Remember for a second that I'm not an alien.
I drop to a knee in front of Bernie Kosar. You have to take this shirt, I say to him. Drag it across the ground as fast as you can for 2 or 3 miles. We'll cross the river so the bloodhound loses our scent and follows this one instead. Then we'll run some more. You should have no trouble catching up to us if you fly. Bernie Kosar transforms into a large bald eagle, takes the shirt into his talons, and speeds off. No time to waste, I say, gripping the chest in my left arm so I can swim with my right. Just as I'm about to jump into the water, Six grabs my bicep.
Sam's right. We'll freeze, John, she urges.
She looks afraid. They're too close. We have no other choice, I say. She bites her lip, her eyes sweeping the river, and turns back to me, giving my arm another squeeze.
Yes, we do,
she says. She lets go of my arm, and the whites of her eyes glisten in the dark. She pushes me behind her and takes a step towards the water, then tilts her head in a gesture of concentration. The bloodhound barks, closer than before. She exhales slowly. At the same time, she lifts her hands out in front of her, and as they come up, the waters of the river begin to part right there before us. With a loud rushing sound, the water foams and churns as it recedes upward to reveal a muddy path 5 feet wide that cuts across to the other bank. The water hovers, looking like a wave ready to crash. But instead, it hangs suspended while icy mist coats our faces.
Go!
She orders, her face strained in concentration, her eyes on the water. Sam and I jump down from the bank. My feet sink, and the mud comes nearly to my knees, but it still beats swimming in 40-degree temperatures in the dead of night. We tramp through it, taking big steps and struggling to lift our feet from the heavy mud. Once we're across, Six follows, rotating her hands as she passes through the massive waves, ready to crash into each other. Waves of her own creation. She climbs up the bank and then lets it go. The waves smash down with a deep, hollow thud, as though someone has just done a cannonball into it. The water rises and falls, and then looks no different than it did before.
Amazing, Sam says. Just like Moses.
Come on. We have to get into the trees so the dog can't see us, she says.
The plan works. After just a few minutes, the dog pauses at the riverbank and sniffs wildly. He circles several times and then rushes after Bernie Kosar. Sam, Six, and I take off in the opposite direction, just inside the tree line but near enough to still see the river, going as fast as Sam's legs will permit. The sound of men's voices yelling to one another reaches us for the first few minutes, until we outrun them. 10 minutes after that, we hear the first whirr of a helicopter. We stop and wait for it to appear. A minute later, a spotlight shines high in the sky a few miles away, in the direction Bernie Kosar has flown. The light sweeps the hills, shining one way, rushing the other.
He should have been back already, I say.
He's fine, John, Sam says. He's BK, the most resilient beast I know.
He has a broken leg. But 2 healthy wings, Six counters. He's fine.
We have to keep going. They'll figure it out soon, if they haven't already.
We have to stay ahead. The longer we wait, the closer they'll get.
I nod. She's right. We have to keep going.
After a half mile, the river takes a sharp turn to the right, back towards the highway, away from the hills. We stop and huddle beneath the low branches of a tall tree.
Now what?
Sam asks. No idea, I say. We turn in the direction in which we had just fled. The helicopter is closer now, its spotlight still sweeping back and forth across the hills. We have to leave the river, I say.
Yes, we do,
Six says.
He'll find us, John, I promise.
We hear an eagle scream high in the treetops, not far off. It's too dark to see where he is, and perhaps too dark for him to see us. I don't think twice about it. Even if it will give away our position, I aim my palms towards the sky and turn my lights on, letting them shine as brightly as I can for a full half second. We wait, listening with our breaths held and heads craned, and then I hear a dog's pant, and Bernie Kosar, changed back into a beagle, comes charging up from the riverbank. He's out of breath, but excited, his tongue falling from his mouth and his tail whipping in the air 1,000 miles an hour. I bend down and pet him. Good job, buddy, I say, planting a kiss on the top of his head. And then it happens. A quick end to a celebration that was only just beginning. While I'm on bended knee, a second copter shoots up over the hill behind us, instantly hitting us with its bright spotlight. I bolt to my feet, blinded at once by the glaring beam.
Run!
Six says. We do, sprinting up the nearest hill. The helicopter drops down and hovers, so the wind off its rotors beats against our backs and causes the trees to bow. The forest floor is a haze of debris, and I drape my arm across my mouth to breathe, keeping my eyes squinted to alleviate the stinging dirt. How long until the FBI is called?
Stay where you are!
A male voice blares from the copter.
You're all under arrest!
We hear shouts. The officers on foot can't be more than 500 feet away. Six stops running, which causes Sam and me to do the same.
We're toast, Sam yells.
Okay, you bastards, we'll do this the hard way,
Six says under her breath. She drops the bags, and for a second, I think she plans to make Sam and me invisible. Well, I have no problem with leaving the bags behind. What does she expect me to do with the chest? She can't make all of us invisible, and that, too. A brilliant stroke of lightning splits the night sky in two, followed by the deep groan of rolling thunder.
John!
She yells without looking away.
Right here!
Take care of the cops! Keep them away from me!
Now I understand. I shove the chest into Sam's arms, who stands beside me, unsure of what to do.
Guard this with your life, I tell him, and stay down.
I turn to Bernie Kosar and communicate that he needs to stay with Sam in case our plan falls apart. I sprint down the hill as another bolt of lightning, chased by a clap of thunder, dark and menacing in tone, flashes across the sky. Good luck, fellas, I think, knowing full well the power of Six's abilities. You're going to need it. I reach the bottom and hide behind an oak. The voices draw near, moving swiftly towards both pillars of light. Rain begins to fall, cold and heavy. I glance up through the thick drops and see both helicopters struggling against the gale force winds, but somehow still keeping their beams steady. That won't last for long. The first two officers blow past me, followed closely behind by a third. I reach out with my mind when they're 15 feet away, grab all three in mid-stride, and yank them towards the thick oak. They surge backwards so fast, I have to leap out of the way to keep from being hit. Two of them fall lifelessly to the ground, knocked unconscious by the tree. The third lifts his head, confused, then reaches for his gun. I tear it from its holster before his hand even touches it. The metal feels cold against my palm, and I turn to the two copters and hurl it like a bullet at the nearest. That's when I see the eyes, doleful and black in the middle of the storm. Soon the old, withered face takes shape. The same face I saw in Ohio when Six killed the beast that wrecked the school.
"Don't move a muscle,"
I hear behind me.
"Hands in the air."
I turn to the officer. Without his gun, he aims his taser straight at my chest. "Which is it? Hands in the air or don't move a muscle? I can't do both." He cocks the taser.
"Don't be a smart-ass, kid," he says.
Lightning cracks, followed by a roar of thunder that makes the officer jump in surprise. The officer looks towards the sound, and his eyes open wide in alarm. The face in the clouds. It's awoken. I rip the taser from his hand, then punch him hard in the chest. He sails 30 feet backwards and crashes into the side of a tree. While my back is still turned, the crack of a nightstick slams against my skull. I fall face first in the mud, and sparkling fuzz fills my vision. I turn as quickly as I can, lift my hand towards the cop who hit me, and get a firm grip around him before he's able to hit me again. He grunts, and with all of my might, I throw him as hard as I can straight up in the air. He screams until he's up so high I can no longer hear him over the copter blades and rumbling thunder. I feel the back of my head and look at my hand. It's covered with blood. I catch the officer when he's within 5 feet of dying. I let him hover a few seconds before tossing him against a tree, knocking him unconscious. A loud explosion tears through the night, and the whir of the copters cuts off. The wind stops. The rain stops, too.
"John!"
Six screams from the top of the hill, and somehow, in the pleading, desperate tone of her voice, I know what she needs me to do. The lights in my hands snap on. Two glowing spotlights, every bit as bright as those just extinguished. Both helicopters are wrecked and twisted, and smoke pours from them as they free fall. I don't know what the face has done to them, but Six and I must save the people aboard. As they torpedo down, the helicopter farthest from me jerks upwards. Six is trying to stop it. I don't think she'll be able to, and I know that I can't. It's too heavy. I close my eyes. Remember the basement in Athens? The way you captured everything inside the room to stop the speeding bullet? And that's what I do. Feeling everything inside the cockpit's interior, the controls, the weapons, the chairs, the three men sitting in them. I grab hold of the men, and as the trees begin to snap under the weight of the falling copter, I yank all three out. The copter crashes to the ground. Six's copter hits the ground at the same time as mine. The explosions reach out over the treetops. Two red balls of fire floating up from the twisted steel. I hold the three men in the air a safe distance from the damage and bring them carefully to the ground. Then I race back up the hill to Six and Sam.
"Holy crap,"
Sam says, his eyes wide open. "Did you pull them free?" I ask Six. She nods.
"Just in time."
"Me too," I say. I grab the chest from Sam and thrust it into Six's arms. Sam picks up our bags.
"Why are you giving me this?"
Six asks.
"Because we have to get the hell out of here," I say. I grab Sam and drape him across my shoulders.
"Hold on," I yell. We sprint away,
deeper into the hills away from the river. Bernie Kosar in the lead as a hawk. Let the cops try to keep up now, I think. It's hard running with Sam on my shoulders, but I still keep a pace 3 times faster than what he could run on his own, and a far faster pace than any of the officers. Their yelling voices fade away, and after both helicopters just crashed in a heaping mess, who's to say they're even following? After 20 minutes of a full-on sprint, we stop in a small valley. Sweat runs down my face. I shrug Sam off, and he drops the bags. Bernie Kosar lands.
"Well, I imagine we're going to be all over the news again after that," Sam says.
I nod. Staying hidden is going to be a lot harder than I thought. I bend over at the waist, catching my breath with my hands on my knees. I smile, which quickly changes to a kind of incredulous half-laugh over what just happened. Six grins crookedly, adjusts the chest in her arms, and begins climbing the next hill.
"Come on, guys," she says. "We're far from out of the woods just yet."
Chapter 8. We hop a freight train in Tennessee, and once we are settled, Six tells us about her and Katerina being captured while they were in upstate New York, just a month after narrowly escaping the Mogadorians in West Texas. This second time around, after botching the first attempt, the Mogadorians had planned well, and when they stormed the room, they totaled more than 30 in number. Six and Katerina had been able to take a few down, but they were quickly bound, gagged, and drugged. When Six woke up, having no idea how much time had passed, she was alone in a cell in a hollowed-out mountain. She didn't discover she was in West Virginia until some time later. Six learned the Mogadorians had been trailing them the entire time, observing, hoping the two might lead them to the others, because, in Six's words, "Why kill one when the others might be near?" I shift uneasily when she says this. Maybe she is still being followed, and they are waiting for the perfect time to kill us. "They had bugged our car when we were eating in the diner in Texas, and it never once occurred to either of us to check," she says, and then gives herself over to a long silence. Aside from an iron door containing a sliding hatch in its center for food to be delivered through, her tiny cell was made entirely of rock, measuring 8 feet on each side. She had no bed or toilet, and the cell was pitch black. The first 2 days passed in total darkness and silence, without food or water, though she never felt hungry or thirsty, which, she said she later learned, was due to the charm's effect. And she had started to believe she'd been forgotten. But her luck hadn't been that good. And on the third day, they came for her.
"When they opened the door, I was huddled in the far corner. They threw a bucket of cold water on me, picked me up, blindfolded me, and pulled me away."
After being dragged down a tunnel, they let her walk on her own while surrounded by 10 or so Moogs. She could see nothing, but heard plenty. Screams and cries from other prisoners there for who knows what reasons. When he heard this, Sam perked up and seemed about to interrupt and ask questions, but said nothing. The roars of beasts locked away in their own cells and metallic clanking. And then she had been thrust in a room, had her wrists chained to a wall, and been gagged. They'd ripped off her blindfold, and when her eyes finally adjusted, she saw Katerina on the opposite wall, also chained and gagged, and looking far worse than Six felt.
"And then he finally entered, a Mogadorian who looked no different from someone you're likely to pass on the street. He was small, had hairy arms, and a thick mustache. Almost all of them had mustaches,
as though they had learned to blend in by watching movies from the early 80s. He wore a white shirt, and the top button was undone, and for some reason my eyes focused on the thick tuft of black hair poking out. I looked into his dark eyes, and he smiled at me in a way that told me he was looking forward to doing what he was about to do, and I started to cry. I slid down the wall until I dangled from the shackles around my wrists, watching through my tears as he pulled razor blades, knives, pliers, and a drill from the desk they had in the center of the room. When the Mogadorian had finished removing over 20 instruments, he'd gone to 6 and stood inches from her face so that she could smell his sour breath.
"Do you see all of these?"
he'd asked. She didn't respond.
"I intend to use each and every one of them on you and your Sepan, unless you truthfully answer every question I ask. If you don't, I assure you that both of you will wish you were dead."
He picked one up, a thin razor blade with a rubber-coated handle, and caressed the side of Six's face with it.
"I've been hunting you kids for a very long time,"
he'd said.
"We've killed two of you. And now we have one right here. Whatever number you are, as you might imagine, I hope you are number 3.
Six had made no response, pushing herself against the wall as though she might disappear into it. The Mogadorian grinned, the flat end of the razor still touching her face. Then he twisted it, so the blade pressed against her cheek, and while looking deep into her eyes, he jerked the razor down and made a long, thin gash along her face. Or rather, he tried to, but it had been his own face that was slit open. Blood instantly poured down his cheek, and he screamed in pain and anger, kicking the desk over, sending all of his tools flying. And he stormed from the room. Six and Katerina had been dragged back to their cells, kept in darkness another 2 days before finding themselves again gagged and chained to the walls of the room. Sitting on the desk with his cheek bandaged, sat the same Moog, looking far less certain of himself than he had before. He jumped from the desk and removed Six's gag, grabbed the same razor he had tried cutting her with, and held it up in front of her face, twisting it so that the light glimmered along the blade.
"I don't know what number you are."
For a second, she'd thought he would try to cut her again, but he turned and crossed the room to Katerina instead. He stood at her side while looking at Six, and then he touched the blade to Katerina's arm.
"But you're going to tell me right now."
"No!"
Six had screamed. And then, very slowly, the Mogadorian made an incision down Katerina's arm just to be certain he could. His grin widened, and beside the original cut he made another. This one, deeper than the first. Katerina groaned in pain while the blood ran down her arm.
"I can do this all day. Do you understand me? You're going to tell me everything I want to know, starting with, what number are you?"
Six had closed her eyes. When she reopened them, he was at the desk, turning over a dagger that changed colors with movement. He'd held it up, wanting Six to see the blade twist and glow as it came to life. Six could feel its hunger, its desperation for blood.
"No, your number. 4, 7. Are you lucky enough to be number 9?
Katerina had shaken her head in an attempt to keep Six quiet, and Six knew that no amount of torture would ever cause her Sepan to talk. But she also knew she preferred death to seeing Katerina maimed and mutilated. The Mogadorian had gone to Katerina, lifted the dagger so the tip was just over her heart. It jerked in his hand, as though the heart was a magnet pulling it forward. He looked into Six's eyes.
"I have all the time in the galaxies for this,"
he'd said without emotion.
"While you are in here with me, we are out there with the rest of you. Don't think anything has stopped us from moving forward, because we have you. We know more than you think, but we want to know everything. If you don't want to see her sliced into little pieces, then you better start talking, and fast. And every single word that comes out better be true. I will know if you're lying."
Six had told him everything she remembered about leaving Lorien and the trip here. The chests, where they'd been hiding. She talked so fast that most of it came out jumbled. Six told him she was number 8, not wanting to tell him the whole truth. And there was something about the desperation in her voice that caused him to believe it.
"You really are weak, aren't you? Your relatives on Lorien, as easy as they fell, at least they were fighters. At least they had some bravery and dignity. But you..."
he'd said, and shook his head as if disappointed.
"You have nothing, number 8.
And then he jammed the knife forward through Katerina's heart. All Six could do was scream. Their eyes had met for a single second before Katerina drifted away, her mouth still gagged, slowly sliding down the wall until the chain had run out of slack and she hung limply by her wrists as the light drained from her eyes.
"They were going to kill her anyway," Six says softly. "Telling them what I did, at least I spared her from horrible torture, as if there's any comfort in that."
Six wraps her arms around her knees and stares at some abstract point out the window of the train.
"Of course there's comfort in that," I offer,
wishing I were brave enough to stand and wrap my arms around her. To my surprise, Sam is that brave. He stands and makes his way over to her. He doesn't say a word when he sits down next to her, instead opening his arms. Six buries her face in Sam's shoulder and cries. She eventually pulls back and wipes her cheeks.
"When Katerina was dead, they tried everything, and I mean everything they could to kill me. Electrocution? Drowning? Explosives? They injected me with cyanide, which did nothing. I didn't even feel the needle going into my arm. They threw me in a chamber filled with poisonous gas, and it was like the air inside was the freshest I'd ever breathed. The Mogadorian who pushed the button on the other side of the door, though, he was dead within seconds."
Six takes another swipe at her cheek with the back of her hand.
"It's funny, you know, that I think I killed more Mogadorians when I was captured than I did at the school in Ohio. They finally threw me in another cell, and I think they'd planned on keeping me there until they killed 3 through 7.
"I love that you told them you were number 8, Sam says.
"I feel bad that I did it now. It's like I tarnished Katerina's legacy, or the real number 8s.
Sam places his hands on both her shoulders.
"No way, Six.
"How long were you in there?" I ask. 185 days, I think.
My mouth drops open.
Over half a year locked away, completely and utterly alone, waiting to be killed. I'm so sorry, Six.
I was just waiting and praying for my legacies to finally develop so I could get the hell out of there. And then one day, the first one finally did. It was after breakfast. I looked down and my left hand just wasn't there. Of course I freaked out, but then I realized I could still feel my hand. I tried to pick up my spoon and sure enough, I could. And that's when I understood what was happening. And invisibility was the thing I needed in order to escape.
How it started for Six wasn't all that different from how it had started for me, when my hand began to glow in the middle of my first class at Paradise High. 2 days later, Six had been able to make herself completely invisible. And when dinner rolled around that day, and the slot on the door was slid open, and her meal pushed through, the Mogadorian guard saw an empty cell. He'd looked wildly around and then hit an alarm that sent a piercing wail through the cave. The iron door had been flung open, and 4 Mogs charged in. While they stood there, dumbfounded as to how she'd escaped, she slid by and rushed out the door and down the tunnel, seeing the cave for the very first time. It had been a massive, labyrinthine network of long, interconnected tunnels that were dark and drafty. There were cameras everywhere. She'd passed thick glass windows revealing chambers that looked like scientific labs, clean and brightly lit. The Mogadorians inside had worn white plastic suits and goggles, but she'd raced by so swiftly, she couldn't tell what they were doing. A sprawling room housed 1,000 or so computer screens, with a Mogadorian sitting in front of each, and Six assumed they were looking for signs of us. Just like Henri, I thought. One tunnel was lined with heavy steel doors she had been sure held other prisoners. But she sped on, knowing her legacy was far from developed, and terrified she wouldn't stay invisible for very long. The siren had continued to wail, and then she reached the heart of the mountain, a great, cavernous hall 1/2 mile wide and so dark and murky she could hardly see to its other side. The air had been stifling, and Six was already sweating. The walls and ceiling were lined with huge wooden trellises to keep the cave from collapsing, and narrow ledges chiseled into the rock face connected the tunnels dotting the dark walls. Above her, several long arches had been carved from the mountain itself to bridge the great divide from one side to the other. She had pressed herself against a rocky crag, her eyes darting back and forth for a way out. The number of passageways had been endless. She'd stood there, overwhelmed, her eyes sweeping across the hollow darkness, seeing nothing at all that looked promising. But then she did. Far across the ravine, a pale pinprick of natural light at the end of a wider tunnel. Just before she climbed the wooden trellis to reach the stone bridge that led to it, something else caught her eye. The Mogadorian who had killed Katerina. She couldn't let him get away. She followed him. He entered the room where he had killed Katerina.
I went straight to his desk and took the sharpest razor I saw, then grabbed him from behind and slit his throat. And as I watched the blood gush and spread across the floor, followed by him bursting into ash, I found myself wishing that it would have been possible to kill him a little more slowly. Or to kill him again.
What did you do when you finally got out? I asked.
I hiked up the opposite mountain, and when I got up there, I stared down at the cave for an hour, trying to remember every little detail I could. Once I was satisfied with that, I took note of everything I passed on the 5-mile run to the nearest road. And from there, I jumped on the back of a slow pickup truck. When it stopped a few miles down the road to get gas, I stole his map, a notepad, and a couple of pens from the cab. Oh, and a bag of potato chips.
Nice. What kind of chips? Sam asks.
Dude,
I say.
What?
They were barbecue, Sam. I marked the cave's location on the map I showed you guys back at the motel. And in the notepad, I drew a diagram of everything I remembered, like a chart that would lead whoever read it straight to its entrance. I kind of panicked and hid the diagram not far from the town, but kept the map. Then I stole a car and drove straight to Arkansas. But of course, by then, my chest had long since been taken.
I'm so sorry, Six.
Me too, she says. But they can't open it without me anyway. Maybe I'll get it back someday.
At least we still have mine, I reply.
You should open it soon, she says. And I know she's right.
I should have opened it already. Whatever's in that chest, whatever secrets it holds, Henri had wanted me to know them. The secrets. The chest. He had said as much in his final breaths. I feel stupid for having put it off this long. But whatever's in the chest, I have a feeling it's going to set the four of us on a long uphill journey. I will, I say. Let's just get off this train and find a safe place first.
Chapter 9. I'm the first one out of bed when the morning bell rings. I always am. It's not necessarily because I'm a morning person, but because I prefer being in and out of the bathroom before anyone else. I rush through making my bed, which I've gotten very good at over time. The key is getting the sheet, blanket, and comforter tucked deeply in at the foot. From there, it's just a matter of pulling the rest to the head, tucking the sides, and adding pillows to give it that clean, a quarter could be bounced off it finish. By the time I'm done, across the room in the bed nearest to the door, Ella, the girl who arrived on Sunday, is the only other one up. Like the previous two mornings, she's trying to emulate the way I make my bed, though she's struggling with it. Her problem is that she's trying to work from the top down instead of the bottom up. While Sister Catherine has been lenient with Ella, her rotation ends today, and Sister Dora's week-long shift begins tonight. I know she won't allow Ella to skimp on perfection, regardless of how new she is or what she's going through. "Would you like help?" I ask, crossing the room. She looks at me with sad eyes. I can see she doesn't care about the bed. I imagine she doesn't care about much of anything right now, and I can't blame her, given the death of her parents. I'd like to tell her not to worry, that unlike those of us who are lifers, she'll be out of this place within the month, two at the most. But what consolation can that be to her now? I bend down at the foot of the bed and pull the sheet and blanket until there's enough to tuck them both beneath the mattress. Then I stretch her comforter over them both. "Wanna grab that side?" I ask, nodding to the left of the bed while I go to the right. Together, we give the whole bed the same tight, clean look as my own. "Perfect," I say.
"Thank you,"
she replies in her soft, timid voice. I look down into her big brown eyes and can't help but like her and feel some need to look after her. "I'm sorry to hear about your parents," I say. Ella looks away. I think I've overstepped my boundaries. But then she offers me a slight smile.
"Thank you. I miss them a lot.
I'm sure they miss you, too." We leave the room together, and I notice she walks on the balls of her feet so as not to make a sound. At the bathroom sink, Ella grips her toothbrush near the top, almost touching the bristles with her small fingers, making the toothbrush appear larger than it really is. When I catch her staring at me in the mirror, I grin. She grins back, showing two rows of tiny teeth. Toothpaste pours from her mouth and runs down her arm, dripping from her elbow. I watch it, thinking the S pattern it creates is familiar, and I let my mind wander. A hot summer day in June. Clouds drift in the blue sky. Cool waters ripple in the sun, The fresh air carries hints of pine. I breathe it in and let the stress of Santa Teresa melt away into nothingness. Though I believe my second legacy developed shortly after the first, I didn't discover it until almost a full year later. It was an accident I discovered it at all, which makes me wonder if I have other legacies waiting to be uncovered. Every year, when school lets out for summer, to reward those of us who have been what the sisters deem good, a 4-day trip to a nearby mountain camp is organized. I've always loved the trip, for the same reason I love the cave that sits hidden in the opposite direction. It's an escape, a rare opportunity to spend 4 days swimming in the huge lake nestled in the mountains, or a chance to hike, to sleep beneath the stars, to smell the fresh air away from the musty corridors of Santa Teresa. It is, in essence, a chance to act our age. I've even caught some of the sisters laughing and smiling when they think nobody's looking. In the lake, there's a floating dock. I'm a horrible swimmer, and for many summers, I just sat and watched from shore while the others laughed and played and did flips off the dock into the water. It took a couple summers of practicing alone in the shallow water, but the summer of my 13th year, I finally learned an imperfect and slow doggy paddle that kept my head above water. It got me to the dock, and that was enough for me. At the dock, the game is to try to push each other off it. Groups team up until they're the only ones left. And then, it's every girl for herself. As the biggest and strongest at Santa Teresa, I used to think it'd be an effortless victory for La Gorda, but it rarely is. She's often outsmarted by the smaller, more wily girls, and I don't think anyone has won as many times as a girl named Bonita. I didn't want to play La Reina del Muelle, Queen of the Dock. I was content to sit on the side and let my feet dangle in the water. But Bonita shoves me hard from behind anyway, sending me headlong into the lake. "Play the game or go back to shore," Bonita says, flicking her hair over her shoulder. I climb back up and rush straight towards her. I shove her as hard as I can, and she falls backwards and crashes into the lake. I don't hear La Gorda behind me, and suddenly, two strong hands shove me hard from behind. My feet slip on the wet wood, and the side of my head and shoulder smack against the edge of the dock, clouding my vision with stars. I'm knocked unconscious for a second, and when my eyes open, I'm underwater. I see nothing but darkness, and instinctively kick upward, flailing my arms to reach the surface. But my head smacks against the bottom of the dock, and I realize there are only a few inches of space between the water and the wooden boards of the dock. I try to tilt my head backwards to put my nose and mouth above the surface, but water instantly laps into my nostrils. I panic, my lungs already burning. I scramble to the left, but there's nowhere to go. I'm trapped by the dock's plastic barrels. Water fills my lungs, while the absurdity of death by drowning pops into my head. I think of the others, how their ankles are about to be seared. Will they believe that number 3 has been killed? Or will they somehow know it's me? Will it burn differently than if I'd died at the hands of the Mogadorians instead of my own stupidity? My eyes slowly close, and I begin to sink. Just as I feel the last stream of bubbles escape my lips, my eyes snap open, and an odd sort of calm sweeps in. My lungs are no longer burning. I'm breathing. The water tickles my lungs, but at the same time satisfies every desperate need I have to breathe. And that's when I know I've discovered my second legacy, the ability to breathe underwater. I found it only because I was pushed to the brink of death. I don't want to be found just yet by the girls diving into the water looking for me. So I let myself drift down to the deep bottom. the world slowly fading to black, until my feet finally sink into the cold mud. I can see through the brown, murky water once my eyes adjust. 10 minutes pass, then 20. Finally, the girls swim away from the dock. I assume the lunch bell's been rung. I wait until I'm absolutely sure they've all left. Then, I walk slowly along on the lake's bottom towards shore, my feet sinking into the mud as I inch forward. After a while, the icy water begins to warm and brighten, and the mud segues to rocks and then to sand, and finally, my head emerges. I listen to the girls, La Gorda and Bonita included, scream and splash towards me in relief. I take inventory of myself on shore, noticing a gash on my shoulder is bleeding, leaving a trail of blood down my arm in the shape of a subtle S. The sisters make me sit the rest of the afternoon at a picnic table under a tree, but I didn't mind. I had another legacy. In the bathroom, Ella catches me watching the toothpaste run down her arm in the mirror. She looks embarrassed, and as she tries to replicate the way I brush my teeth, even more frothy toothpaste pours from her mouth. "You're like a bubble factory," I say with a smile, grabbing a towel to clean her up. We leave the bathroom as the others are arriving, dress quickly in the room, and walk out of it as the others are coming in, keeping just ahead of the group, as I prefer to do. We grab our lunches from the cafeteria and head out into the cold morning. I eat my apple on the walk to school. Ella does the same. I'm about 10 minutes early today, which will give me a little time to get on the internet to see if there's anything new about John Smith. The thought of him makes me smile.
"Why are you smiling? Do you like school?" Ella asks.
I look over at her. The half-eaten apple looks big in her small hand. "It's a nice morning, I guess," I say. "And I have good company today." We walk through town as street vendors set up shop. The snow hasn't melted and is piled along both sides of Calle Principal, but the road itself is clear. Up ahead, on the right, Hector Ricardo's front door opens, and out comes his mother in a wheelchair, being pushed by Hector. She's had Parkinson's disease for a very long time. She's been in a wheelchair for the last 5 years, and she's been unable to speak for the last 3. He positions her in a sliver of sunlight and applies her wheel brakes. While the sun seems to bring her some comfort, Hector slinks away and sits in the shade, dropping his head. "Good morning, Hector," I call out. He lifts his head and squints, one eye open. He waves with a shaky hand.
"Marina, as of the sea," he croaks. "The only limits of tomorrow are the doubts we have today."
I stop and smile. Ella stops too. "That's one of your better ones."
"Don't doubt Hector. He has a few nuggets left," he says.
"Are you doing okay?"
"Strength, confidence, humility, love. Hector Ricardo's 4 tenets of a happy life," he says,
which makes no sense whatsoever considering the question I asked, but it makes me feel good anyway. He turns his gaze on Ella.
"And who's this little angel?"
Ella grabs my hand and hides behind me. "Her name is Ella," I say, looking down at her. "This is Hector. He's my friend."
"Hector is one of the good guys," he says,
though Ella remains behind me. He waves at us as we walk the rest of the way to school.
"Do you know where you're going?" I ask her. "I have Senora Lopez's class," she says, smiling.
"Ah,
you're a lucky girl. I had her too. She's one of the good ones in this town. Like Hector," I say.
I'm devastated. All three of the school computers are occupied. A trio of younger girls from town are desperately trying to finish a science assignment, their fingers flying across the keyboards. I coast through the day, keeping to myself as one thing runs through my mind. John Smith, on the run in America, somehow staying ahead of the law. And I'm stuck here, in Santa Teresa, an old, moldy town where nothing happens. I'd always thought I'd leave when I turned 18. But now that John Smith is out there being hunted, I know I have to leave as soon as I can to join him. The only question now is how to find him. My last class is Spanish history. The teacher drones on about General Francisco Franco in the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. I tune her out and instead write in my notebook about John, what I know based on the most recent article I read. John Smith lived 4 months in Paradise, Ohio, pulled over by an officer in Tennessee driving west in a pickup truck, middle of the night, with two other people around the same age. Where were they driving? One of the two people he was with is believed to be Sam Good, also from Paradise, originally thought to be a hostage, now considered an accomplice. Who is the third person? A girl with black hair. Girl in my dream had black hair. Where is Henri? How did they get away from two helicopters and 35 police officers? How did the two copters crash? How can I contact him or the others? Post something on internet? Too dangerous. Is there a way to do so that eludes the Moogs? If so, will any of the others even see it? John is on the run. Ever checking internet? Does Adelina know something that I don't? Can I bring it up to her without being obvious? The pen hovers over the page. The internet and Adelina, my only two ideas, neither of which seems promising. What more can I do, though? Everything else seems as futile as walking up the mountain and sending smoke signals into the air. But I can't help but feel like I'm missing something. Some crucial element that's so obvious it's staring me right in the face. The teacher drones on. I close my eyes and think it all through. 9 guard, 9 sepan. An airship that brought us to Earth. The same airship to take us back eventually, hidden somewhere on Earth. All I remember about it is that we landed in a remote place in the midst of a thunderstorm. A charm was cast to protect us from the Mogadorians, which went into effect only when we scattered, and that only works if we stay away from each other. But why? A charm that keeps us apart seems pretty counterintuitive in helping us fight and defeat the Mogadorians. What's the point in it? While asking myself this question, my mind stumbles on something else. I close my eyes and let the logic carry me. We were meant to hide, but for how long? Until our legacies developed and we had the tools to fight, to win. What's the one thing we're able to do when that first legacy finally arrives? The answer seems too obvious to be correct. With the pen still in my hand, I write the only answer I can come up with. The chest.
Chapter 10. I no longer sleep without nightmares. Every night I'm stricken by Sarah's face, there for only a second before it's swallowed by darkness, followed by her calling out for help. No matter how furiously I search, she's nowhere to be found. She keeps calling, a scared voice, bleak and alone, that I can never find her. And then there's Henri, his body twisted and smoking as he looks at me, knowing our end together has finally come. It's never fear I see in his eyes, or regret, or sadness, but rather pride, relief, and love. He seems to tell me to go on, to fight, to win. Then, right at the end, his eyes widen in a plea for more time.
"Coming here, to paradise, it wasn't by chance," he says again,
and I still have no idea what he means. Then...
I wouldn't have missed a second of it, Guido. Not for all of Lorien. Not for the whole damn world.
This is my curse, that every time I dream of Henri, I'm forced to watch him die.